This is a tool. This is a tool. This is a tool. This is a tool. This is a
Corniolo, Mugello Valley, August 30th, 2014. Emmy Franceschini is visiting professor at the third decompression gathering summer camp, organized by collective Radical Intention, together with Valeria Del Baglino.
My name is Amy Franceschini, and I'm part of a collective called Future Farmers, and I'm one of five core members. We're based in San Francisco, and we're sitting here today at Radical Intention in Tuscany. The project here was, first of all, to be in Radical Intention, to know what that is. And I'm very interested in alternative modes of learning and alternative ways of knowing and questioning how we know. So when Radical Intention invited me here, I was very interested in trying to exchange with a group of people through making as much as possible. And so we decided to build an oven, a bread oven, a pizza oven, a baking oven. Right now it's a beautiful smoking machine.
In Corniolo, she turned to traditions connected to the bread production as a means to question ideas of collectivity and social engagement. And she's not new to occupying food production processes as a means to activate communities.
Look outside. The sun's out. Someone's mowing their lawn. You know it's going to be a good day.
For me, it's really about communication and resilience. And I think there was an example which is really interesting. I think when people come together to supply their own food, they have to communicate and network and work together. And it's a way of creating a very strong community. So in San Francisco in the 60s, the Black Panthers were a very activist group for the Black movement in the Bay Area. And one way they thought that they could work outside of the system was to control their own food supply. So they started buying food in bulk. So it was a neighborhood would get together and say, hey, let's buy all of our food together. I have a garage. We'll have it all sent to the garage on Wednesdays at 5:00. It comes. And they would ask everyone what they wanted to eat and make a map of it and buy, 50 gallons of milk, 60 gallons of whatever. And on Wednesdays, people would come get the food. And by having to come together and kind of seeing a little bit of transparency of people's daily lives, they also started to organize and say, hey, there's a rally about this issue on Saturday. We should all come. So it became an organizing mechanism, which really strengthened the Black Panther movement. And the project they called it was the Food Conspiracy. The food conspiracy was very interesting. How they evolved was the neighborhood started to get stronger, but they felt that they were staying within their neighborhoods and they wanted to have a centralized location to even strengthen the movement. So they got a storefront location and basically kept doing what they're doing. And it's turned into a co-op that still exists called Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco. And it's really a hub of community. It's cooperatively owned. And they give a lot of grants to community activism. So I think food has always been, not just bread, but food has always been really, for me, an interesting tool of communication and resilience in terms of being outside of the system and having a way to kind of reconfigure and, I say fight back, but it doesn't have to be a forceful fight.
That made perfect sense. It was a rational thing to do.
Not by chance, one of the most recent projects she's involved into has to do with bread.
I'm doing a project in Oslo, Norway, a very long-term, large-scale public art project. And it's in a space, a new waterfront development that has three areas that are called the commons. And we've been asked to define one of the commons. And immediately, I think of creating a food commons, especially right now, because There was just international law passed last June that is making it illegal to grow seeds that are not certified. Norway is outside of that. They aren't in the EU, so they don't have the same system, but it's coming quickly. I just started to ask people, what was this land used for before? And they said, oh, it's where they stored grains. And I started thinking about how the ability to store surplus food is really what gave rise to civilization, gave rise to power and wars, education, and to think about this new territory that we're part of in Oslo. No one's lived there, so it's sort of a new beginning. To do a project around grains and food to question our legacy of civilization. So I started asking people if there were people growing ancient grains in the region, and we met a farmer who was growing rye, and it was a very special rye that he read about in a history book. He was reading about the forest Finns. The Finnish people a little bit north of Oslo were growing rye in the late 1800s. They're no longer there anymore because they moved to Finland, but he was like, if they're growing grains that north, it must be really special. I have to find it. So he read further and found that they were storing their grains in these wooden barns. So he got permission to go to one and take it apart and see if he could find any grain. And he found 9 grains between 2 pieces of wood. And he planted them in the church next door to keep them in the place they were last grown. And 7 of the 9 grew. And they were these incredibly large grains, like 1 meter tall, 3 feet. And from one corn, you could get 1,000 corns. They grew the 7 rye, and then he took those, which was like 7,000 rye, and he started a farm, and now he's growing and distributing them. In the region where he grows the grain, every farm has a bakehouse, and they basically grow the grain, mill it, and store it in the form of flatbread. They call it a storage economy, the bread. There's a hole in the middle of the circle, so it almost looks like computer disks, like memory. And they store it in the ceiling, so it's dry and warm. It could last for 20 years.
This is a tool. This is a tool.
Flatbread became interesting to me because it was this currency of survival. But then within the context of Oslo, it's a very diverse, culturally diverse city in Scandinavia compared to Copenhagen or Stockholm. It's a very diverse population in the city center of Iranian, Iraqi, Afghani, Tunisian, Sudanese citizens. And it's the population, or that neighborhood that's so diverse, is right on the border of where our project is. And they are also eating flatbread. And we thought, well, maybe it's interesting to use the flatbread as a way to transverse across these cultures, and that this becomes a currency between the cultures. So we proposed to do a public bakehouse with 3 different ovens, and we did a temporary version last summer to test to see if people would use it, because we thought, we don't want to build a permanent structure that's not going to work. So we built a pretty typical tandoor Middle Eastern oven, a dome oven for raised bread, and then a Scandinavian flat bread oven. And they all were fueled by the same flame. And we did a bit of programming. We did about 3 weeks of programming, but the project took a life of its own and it started to become programmed by other people. The seeds carry the story of resilience for me. That's about the particular seeds we're using are grown in a place, they adapt to a place, they are more robust because they've been reacting to the environment around them. And a question for me right now is really about place. Like, we're all moving globally around the world, and we think, you know, the earth is our place now. But in the food system, you see in America, and I see it starting here in Italy, these very regional food systems, and there starts to be these transition towns and a building of the very kind of hyper-local networks. And I think for me, that is the building of a movement that can be resilient. And what I mean by resilient is, if a storm comes in Abruzzo, if none of the farmers are talking to each other because they don't need to, because they just distribute their food to the distribution unit, they aren't going to say, no, hey, Valerio, can I borrow your tractor because the storm pushed mine down the road, or maybe we can all save money. You know, all of our crops were killed this year because of the storm, but we don't know each other. If people start to know each other and have a more local food system, you can share your resources and be stronger when something unexpected comes. And I think that's what, for me, resilience is.
Let me start with a question.
Going back to 2007, another engaging project through which collective future farmers tried to reoccupy the food production system was the Victory Gardens program in San Francisco, a project that supported the transition of backyards, rooftops, and abandoned lands into food production areas, a project that coordinated diverse spontaneous forces and concerns about the quality of food, the quality of the urban environment, a project that soon risked to be cannibalized by political campaigns and interests.
That made perfect sense. It was a rational thing to do.
America had just invaded Iraq in 2003, and the city hadn't been quite so politicized because of the dot-com movement. The first technology boom in San Francisco created a wave of conservatism and also people just wanting to make money. The political activity in San Francisco was quite low, but as soon as the invasion happened in Iraq, everyone who was politicized was back and talking again. And Victory Gardens was, I would say, the most robust project and durational. It still has effects. I can't take credit for it myself. It was really the right time and the place and putting the pieces together. What that did is it created a movement. I mean, it took a lot of attention on my part to go to the city, find the right people in the city to deal with. I immediately partnered with a gardening group, the oldest funded garden in San Francisco, because I knew, you know, I'm an artist, and to be taken seriously, we need someone who can really grow food. This head gardener said, yes, come on, let's go to the city together. The city got excited because they were under pressure from their own agenda to lower carbon emissions, make people healthier in San Francisco, so their costs went down for healthcare. They had an agenda already to do that, and we just said, hey, if people eat healthier, they're not going to be sick. They're going to be outdoors longer. They're going to be psychologically happier. If we're eating more local food, your carbon emissions are going to go down because you don't have to transport food in and out. For sure, it's not going to feed everybody, but it's going to offset this cost, you know, both atmospherically and on a social level. And they got it right away. The real outcome of that was several. One, there was a financial outcome where we asked them to incorporate funding in their annual budget to fund new gardens, to fund underutilized land, so land that's sitting empty, to make a policy that if a landowner owns the land, they don't have to pay taxes if it's used for gardening. We formed a food policy council, which was the first one in the United States, and it has now translated to many cities, but what it was to have real gardeners from around different neighborhoods be representatives in the government to say, this is what we need in terms of food policy. So to have spokespeople that influenced the neighboring city, Oakland started one. So it really had a ripple effect. And then of course, for the instrumentalization part, we had the garden in front of City Hall, and our mayor was the one who said, yes, you can have it in front of City Hall. But he was also running for governor, and he was in the White House doing a speech about becoming governor. And he said, look, you know, we have this garden in front of City Hall. And everybody was like, wow, they're so progressive. And every other city wanted to be as green as San Francisco. And then all these people were going to come and visit the garden, but we had planned to close the garden. And he said, let's keep it open for another month while all the people come on his campaign tour. But our garden, it starts to look ugly at the end of a season. And we only had a budget to do it for a month and a half. That budget came from a specific pot of money, and then the city had to pay for it. And so people were mad, like, why are we paying for this garden for the mayor's campaign? It's only a campaign tool, and some people didn't want him for governor. So at that point, it was a little tricky, like, hey, our project has just become a mechanism for campaigning. You saw that, yes, he opened the door for different reasons than we might hope for, but I think the other side of that door had way so many positive influences that you kind of have to weigh it out.
Interesting for us is Future Farmers, a recent project in Abruzzo, where they are working on rural heritage and agriculture of future among a spread community of small farmers. A rural radio as a space of encounter, as a platform wherein to speak and to listen is the medium at stake to bring forward their collaboration with Gaetano Carboni's Pollinaria residency program, a collaboration initiated in 2010 when they visited villages and farms, strolling around with a wooden human-powered horse used as a vehicle to exchange visions and hopes of rural regeneration.
The idea came out of our visit 4 years ago to Abruzzo, where we pushed this big human-powered horse around to different villages. Almost every time an old man farmer, which was the predominant community we were talking to, would see the horse, they would go, why the horse, you know? And we would say, yeah, because it wants to ask you what the future of farming is. And then they would just start going crazy, talking, and then more men would come, and they would argue, and they all wanted to tell you their story of farming. And when we would push the horse back onto the trailer to take it home, they would all say, thank you for giving us a way to talk about the future of farming. Like, we just stopped talking about it because there's no hope. We just don't talk about it anymore. So at one point we were proposing to this one farmer, might be nice if you had a radio, if you could transmit radio and talk to each other, because the one thing they said, thank you for coming here and listening. Like, just by listening to us, it's given us reason to go on. Because we're here alone, several of the farmers we met were just subsistence farmers, so they were just growing food for themselves and they never left the farm. Like, one of the brothers could never leave because he had to milk the cow and da-da-da. And he said, yeah, it would be great if I could just shout out and the world could hear that, you know, a pig was born or something. And so we thought, that's really beautiful to think about this space that could be exchanged in a more poetic way between the farmers. And we would meet another farmer and we started to propose the idea, like, yeah, what if you're milking a cow at night and you see a falling star and you can just say, ah, I saw a falling star. And the farmers were like, fantastic, I would love this, you know. So we thought, maybe we can make a sort of receiver and transmitter that is given to maybe 12 farmers in the beginning that are close enough by that they can exchange a bit of poetic content. But then if they needed to use it as a tool, if there's a storm or if they need something, they could use it as a communication tool. We found that during World War II in the United States, they would use the barbed wire, the metal wire on the fences to carry the radio transmission. And one thing the farmers complained about in Abruzzo was that in the last 10 years, there's been all these fences put up because many people from England are coming and they built these big houses and they don't want the wild boar. So they put the fence up, and there used to be wild horses, and now there's no wild horses, and the wild is slowly disappearing. So we thought, how can we make this awful thing into something that's actually empowering the people that it's disempowered? So right now we're researching technically how to do that, but while we were there last month, we thought, you know, it's really hard to change tradition in Italy. And we thought it's probably hard to have a farmer who listens to his one radio station in the tractor to turn it to a pirate radio station or to another transmission. So we started asking farmers, what radio station do you listen to? And they would say Radio Ciao. And then we asked the shepherd who takes a radio for the summer up to his cave, what radio station do you listen to? Radio Ciao. So everybody's listening to Radio Ciao, even the women while they're cooking, Radio Ciao. So Gaetano Carboni, who's our host, called Radio Ciao and asked if we could have some airtime on the radio. And they agreed to a half an hour window, and we're negotiating when it will be. And for me, it doesn't really matter right now, but I think we thought it's maybe more interesting to intervene in this transmission that's already there than to just start out in the outer space.
This is a tool. This is a tool.
The voice is very important. Even if no one is listening, but you give someone the opportunity to talk. I mean, it's the enactment of the imagination, or it's the articulation of our imagination, rather than just thinking about it or imagining. We're enacting it into the voice, and transmitting it, which is giving yourself a voice and a reason.
You don't.